We'll plow on for a while. Well, you're very good and gracious, but let me dig into the pedagogy. Like, what's the pedagogy that might sustain? And some of you have read me on this, and indeed I've been singing this song for quite some time. By the way, I brought some freebies. Here's a little, Church in the 21st Century Center in Boston, publishes a magazine twice a year. And this one is on forming conscience. And I don't think I've enough for everybody, nor might everybody might not be interested in having a copy. But anyway, they're free copies. And if you ever would like to receive them, we mail 200,000 of these. So we're more than welcome to mail them free. They're beautiful magazines. But this one is on conscience and conscience formation. And I think it's a crucial issue for religious educators. Anyway, if you're interested, take one. And this is a little handout on a program that we call Agape Latte, which is a terribly simple idea. It comes out of my office in Boston College again. I've had very little to do with it. My colleagues are much more imaginative than I am in it. But it's a marvelous program. In fact, Justin has shown some real interest in it for one of the schools in Elphin. But it's a simple idea of getting an adult, a respected adult, from the school or from the community to tell a story of faith at a moment or a time or a place in their lives when they had to put faith and life together in a fairly urgent or emergent way. And it's like a 20-minute talk, and then there's topics and questions and comments and answers and all the rest, conversation. But it's been hugely successful. It's now in about 35 American universities and growing. Anyway, there's a little brochure that helps. And Boston College, we do have funding, actually, fairly significant funding, that can help a school get started, because it can take a little money to get it started. And so if you're tempted to bring it into your, especially it'd be for the secondary schools and colleges, but if you're interested. So anyway, a life to faith to life approach. It sounds extraordinarily simple. I write about it more technically as a shared Christian praxis approach. And I've written big books about it, but it's an amazingly simple and user-friendly approach and has become fairly widespread. I don't mean to be pretentious when I say that, but it's fairly popular in the United States. I think most of our Catholic schools and parish programs use some version of this approach. Indeed, the Alive-O curriculum here reflected a very similar pedagogy. We've just published a a curriculum in the United States called a Credo curriculum. I'm the primary architect of it. It's now been used in about 300 Catholic high schools throughout the United States, and it's very much based on a life to faith to life approach. So I don't mean to be pretentious or overclaim for it. I'm just saying this is not idiosyncratic. It also has been translated fairly widely into different cultures, languages, Korean, Chinese, Spanish, and French, of course. And is fairly widely, not widely used, well, varies actually. It's widely used, for example, in the Korean Catholic religious education program, follows it very faithfully. So I'm just saying that, not as I said, to overclaim for it, but to say that it has taken on a life of its own and has been found to be very, pardon me, effective in many different cultures and contexts. We can teach a faith tradition. And this is Michael Grimmett. You're probably very familiar with this, because I'm very conscious of the fact that many of our grade schools now and many of our high school, secondary schools have a varied religious population. And that's a terribly complicated, challenging situation. And I don't mean to pontificate or to have any great wisdom about it. But I think when we do teach theology, religion, religious education, catechesis in our schools, that it's not enough. Or we don't have to settle for people simply learning about it. Now, a lot of the proposals that I've read and people have sent me essays to read before I came are proposals that we just go back to teaching them about it, teach them about religion. I think it's a waste of time. And we can do better. Now, you teach them about it, but you can also teach it in a way that they at least learn from it for their lives. That even you don't proselytize, but they could be enriched by it. I taught undergraduates at Boston College for 35 years. Then they gave me a day job. And I had Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus, all kinds of people in those classes over the years. I taught a course called Catholicism, 1, first semester, Catholicism, 2, second term. And I would always say, now, I want you to be a better Muslim after taking this course. I want you to be a better Jew after taking this course. I want you to be a better Hindu after taking this course. I want you to be enriched by your exposure to this rich tradition of faith that we call Catholic Christian faith. And Murphy, you might consider or reconsider your identity within the tradition as well. So that I think there is a pedagogy that we can give people access to the wisdom and the spiritual wisdom of a tradition, and yet without imposing, if in fact there's people that are from other traditions. And I began thinking and talking about, I was confronted by this some years ago in some extended work that I did in Pakistan. And there's an extraordinary Catholic school system in Pakistan, over 500 Catholic schools. They're the premier school of the country. And Benazir Bhutto stated very explicitly in her autobiography that she never would have entered politics, never would have become Prime Minister of Pakistan if she hadn't gone to Jesus and Mary Convent School. Because she got a way of knowing and an understanding of herself, not in any way disparaging traditional Muslim schools, but she got a whole different outlook on herself and on life and what have you from her experience at Jesus and Mary Convent School in Karachi. I actually stayed there. But in a sense, she learned from. She never became a Christian and couldn't become a Christian in that context. It's a heavily Islamicized country. And the sisters of Jesus and Mary have been there for almost over 200 years now. And they've never had a convert to Christian faith. Nor would they ever want to have one. Because, well, actually they had one. And the girl was murdered by her brothers. So you don't mess around. But they're not trying to proselytize at all. And yet they teach a very substantive catechetical curriculum in their schools. But they do it in a way so that their children are enriched by. Now, they also have catechesis in their Muslim tradition. But there is a pedagogy, I think, that isn't. Now, it can dispose people to become it, especially if that's their tradition, if they're coming from that culture and background and family. But it's not a proselytizing. It doesn't have to be a proselytizing. And yet, they should do more than learn about it. They can learn from it. A religious ed curriculum with Catholic schools, I think, should give persuasive access to the truths and spiritual wisdom of Christian faith, at least in a way that people can learn from it, and maybe disposing students to appropriate it as appropriate. In other words, you don't impose it, you don't proselytize it, but as appropriate to embrace it as their identity, especially if they're coming out of a Catholic culture, a Catholic home, a Catholic family, and so on. You at least do it in a way that disposes them to perhaps embrace it as their own personal identity. I think it requires a pedagogy that engages students' everyday lives. Their generative themes, as Paulo Freire would call them, and I was privileged to have Freire as a great mentor in my life, and was privileged to teach, learn from him, and then to teach with him a number of times at Boston College. But he always talked about find the generative themes in people's lives. What they're interested in, what matters to them, the hopes, the joys, the sorrows, their heart's desires. If you can find that as a starting point, you're off and running. It's a huge asset. But just simply to start teaching into people's lives from up above, down par, just as he would call it, banking education, just taking and depositing in people's lives, it doesn't do very much for them at all. But if you can find a genuine interest, a real issue of their lives, they could be engaged. And then to access into their lives the scriptures, the traditions of Christian faith, or whatever the faith might be. In some of our high schools or secondary schools, you do work with secondary schools, right? As well as with grade schools or primary schools, as you would say. You can be teaching world religions. And I'll come back and give an example of that. And some other tradition. You could be teaching Islam, for example. But you'd access the scriptures, the wisdom, in ways that invites integration into life as spiritual wisdom. And maybe disposes them to consider for their faith identity. So you're trying to raise, because all the world, great world religions, what are they? They're great spiritual wisdoms for life. And in many ways, Catholicism in particular. We think of it as a religion and a faith, and of course it is, and dogmas and doctrines, but ultimately it's a great spirituality. It's a great spiritual wisdom for life. And giving people access to that wisdom rather than just teaching it as information. And I think this is something substantive. I've done some work with the Swedish Department of Education, where they had all these religion classes in their schools, but nobody was interested, and the teachers as little as the students, and they shifted. I came in as an alleged expert, and I encouraged them to shift it to teaching them as great spiritual wisdoms for life rather than learning about religions. Like, you learn there's five pillars of Islam and you can recite them, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But what good does that do? Whereas to say to people, when you stop and think about that Islamic tradition of pausing 5 times a day to pray, could you learn anything from that? Does that suggest anything for you? Why do you think they do it? Why do you think they go on doing it? What would be comparable in your tradition? Would there be anything, any way that you might be tempted to raise your mind and heart to God throughout the day? Would it be a good thing to do? How do you feel about it? You don't want them to buy a prayer mat and turn to Mecca 5 times a day. Now, they may choose to do that, but that's not your learning outcome. And yet you'd want to teach it in a way that they would learn from it, that they'd be impressed by it and inspired by it, even if they don't take it on as their identity. And the same way we teach our Christian faith. How do you think, there's a picture of him teaching. How do you think he went about it? Just for a moment, reflect. What would you think was the, you know Jesus well, and as teachers you've kept an eye on his pedagogy too. What would distinguish his pedagogy? What do you think stood out in how he went about teaching? Because I'm going to propose that not only are we to teach Jesus, but I think we've something to learn from how he taught, even for our time. So we'll definitely have to teach Jesus, but I think how he taught. He is, not that we ape, slavishly ape, you know, he didn't have PowerPoint, he was up on the side of a mountain shouting because he had no amplifier and so on. But when you think about the pedagogy of Jesus, what immediately comes to mind? Tell me. Anybody? Storytelling, absolutely, constantly.
He appealed to their needs.
He appealed to their needs, great point. He appealed to their needs, their desires, their situation, talked into their lives. How else?
He met people where they were at.
Wherever they were, always. Yeah, no matter how they came. Nicodemus came by night. He let him in. Couldn't say, now go back out and come back in the daytime. Always, you know, Zacchaeus, the little old nasty, mean tax collector, bleeding his own people dry, but climbs a tree, Jesus says, come on down, I'm going to stay with you tonight. Met anybody, the woman caught in adultery, just says to her, go your way, sin no more. Met everybody where they were. Extraordinary. Another aspect of his pedagogy, what would you say? They use the everyday. The everyday, the ordinary. I defy you to find a teaching moment in the Gospels when he doesn't begin with people's ordinary, everyday lives. The reign of God is like a bunch of fishermen sorting fish. I bet he was down at the lake shore with a bunch of fishermen and women sorting fish. And he said, the reign of God is very like sorting fish. And they'd look up and say, what do you mean? And then he went on from there. And turned their lives upside down when he went on, because he said that there will be a sorting. See, they would have believed that as sons of Abraham and Sarah, that they were all entitled to the reign of God. He says, no. The little ones will be thrown back in, the dead ones will be go to the birds, and the good ones will be taken to market. In other words, there could be a sorting of who belongs to the reign of God. He would have been turning the world upside down. But he typically, the reign of God, like a woman baking bread. The reign of God is like, you know, the merchant in search of fine pearl. Always the ordinary, the everyday of people's lives. That's where he always began. Other features you might mention that you recognize.
I think he would have had to. I'm just thinking myself now, what would attract me to listening to somebody? Okay, and if you think the people were under Roman rule and everything. So I think he thought the law in, not in a different way, but in a different light.
A different spin.
Yeah, and that maybe it wasn't so much the 635 rules that you had to keep.
Yeah.
So I think he would have had to have good humour and a sense of humour.
I think so, yeah, I think he had. Yeah. I think he had. Yeah, no, he definitely pushed back that you have heard it said, but I say, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I say love your enemy. So he definitely pushed back against and revised and critiqued what people would have taken as absolutely sacred. Yeah, I think you've said it all well. Let me, I think when I imagine him teaching, I can't imagine him just teaching people about the faith. I think he was engaging their lives and getting into their hearts and souls and appealing to their desires and telling them stories and giving them hope. He's described his teaching 150 different times. So it was his primary. It was his primary ministry, was teaching, and I think we can be consistent with how he taught. He appealed to both logos and eros, reason and desire of people, and especially with his reign of God. And his constant intent, I think, of his teaching was to integrate life and faith into a living faith. His overall pedagogy, I propose, was to lead people from life to faith, to life in faith. He began typically with their lives, as you've just said, invited them to faith, but then invited them back to a life in faith. And he did it, if you watch him, it's very obvious. He engaged people's everyday lives. And it's amazing how often the ordinary, the everyday, and, you know, a family had two sons, and one of them said, "Give me half the property." A man going down from Jerusalem to Jericho fell among thieves. There was a beggar at the gate one time, a rich man's gate, and he was totally ignored, Lazarus. And so all of the stuff, look at the birds of the air, look at the lilies of the field, the ordinary, the everyday of people's lives typically began with examples, with issues, with questions, with stuff that was going on. But then often would turn their lives upside down. He would often get them to look at their world in a whole new way. So that the Samaritan is the neighbor. The prodigal is welcomed home when he never should have been welcomed home. He forfeited his birthright according to Mosaic law. Lazarus goes off to the bosom of Abraham and the rich man goes to hell. That would have turned people's world upside down. Even the sorting of the fish would have given them. So he got them to stop and look at their lives, but very often to think about them in a very different way, to question them, get them to give great critical reflection. So get them to look at their life in the world, but then to stand back and critique it and question it. And in the midst of that, then he did teach them his gospel. And Mark, in the very beginning, says he taught it with authority. And of course, he'd no great authority, really. He'd no official authority. He wasn't a member of the Sanhedrin. He wasn't an ordained rabbi. So the authority was, he taught them by his own good reasoning, but also by their desire, by persuasion. And the most persuasive thing was that he lived it. Amazing, all the things he's accused of. Breaking the Sabbath, not keeping the dietary laws. He's never accused of hypocrisy, which when you consider what he taught was extraordinary. Loving enemies, going the extra mile. It was amazing that he had the credibility. And I suppose it's our aspiration as well, but it's very difficult to live that high he never lived to that high a standard. And yet there was a certain authority. So he definitely taught and appealed to people's, constantly appealing to their reason, but to their hearts and desires as well. And encouraged them to see for themselves and to come to personal conviction. And since he began with their lives, invited them to the faith, but then brought them back to a life in faith and to a call to discipleship and inviting them to decisions, to follow the wisdom way as disciples. And that dynamic of going from life to faith to life, I think runs throughout the whole public ministry. But no place is it as vividly reflected is in the extraordinary story from the road to Emmaus. Now, I'll do it very briefly. It's amazing. It says, the text begins by saying that very same day, so it's Easter Sunday morning, two of the disciples, are making their way to a village named Emmaus, about 7 miles distant from Jerusalem, discussing as they went along all that had happened. And you can imagine how brokenhearted, how devastated, how traumatized they are. Their beloved Jesus has just been taken and crucified, and they've lost hope. They even admit that they've lost hope. It says, in the midst of their lively exchange, Jesus himself approached and began to walk along with them. But for some reason, they're restrained from recognizing him. Now, the scripture scholars have spilled buckets of ink, and why didn't they recognize him? And of course, you can imagine yourself why they didn't recognize him. They were traumatized, they weren't expecting him, blah, blah, blah. But my great question is, why didn't he introduce himself? I mean, why didn't he come out and say, "I am the risen Christ"? But he never tells them what to see. He joins their company and walks along with them. And then he says, "Now, what are you discussing?" as you go upon your way. In other words, tell me what's going on in your life. Tell me your story. Tell me your what's going on. Tell me what's happening in your life. What are you discussing as you go upon your way? And they said to him, are you the only one in Jerusalem that doesn't know the things that went on there? And they basically say, my God, are you the? How could you not know what we're talking about? And he said to them, what things? Now, let's agree. Nobody knew better than he what went on in Jerusalem these past few days. And yet he wants them to tell him their story. He wants them to name it. He wants them to reflect on it. This is Freire's version of it. And sure enough, they do. Beginning then they said all the things that had to do with Jesus of Nazareth, the prophet, powerful in the eyes of God and all the people, how we were hoping. He elicits their own story and their shatter. We were hoping he was the one who set Israel free. And so, in other words, we were expecting a political Messiah. And besides all this, some women of their group went to the tomb before dawn and come back with this amazing story. They found a vision. They say the vision of angels who declare that he is alive. Some men of our group went to the tomb but saw nothing. So basically, we're getting the heck out of there before the same thing happens to us. So they have this whole garbled version and a devastated version of the Easter story. And getting them to stop and look at their lives and tell their story and their shattered view. Only then does it say, beginning then with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted for them every passage of scripture that referred to himself and explained that the Messiah had to so suffer so as to enter into his glory. So in other words, he begins with their life, leads them to the faith tradition and the vision of it, that the Messiah had to suffer. So it was a suffering servant Messiah that came, not a political one. But the amazing thing is he still doesn't tell them what to see. He waits for them to come to see for themselves, which they do. And it's the exact same four verbs as at the Last Supper regarding the bread. He took it, he blessed it, he broke it, he gave it. And then with that, their eyes were opened and they recognized him. And the Greek verb there is epigenoskein, which means they were deeply united, they were bonded with him, whereupon he vanishes from their sight. And I often had my students ask me, Tom, why would he vanish? And I said, well, in some ways his work was done. They'd come to see for themselves. And that's the great moment you're hoping for, when people can see for themselves that there's real value here, a real hope here, that God, there could be something here that'd be helpful to my life. I might live better. I might be a better person if I could take and make this my own and see for myself. And of course, that's then they turn. They say they got up immediately and returned to Jerusalem. But before they did that, they said to each other after he disappeared, oh God, weren't our hearts burning? Weren't our hearts burning inside of us as he talked to us on the road and explained the scriptures to us? And that's what I'm talking about, I suppose, all morning. How do we get back into people's hearts rather than just into their heads? How do we tip onto their desires? And I think it can be done. Without being invasive, inappropriate, pious piffle or anything else. But weren't our hearts burning? And they get up immediately and they return to Jerusalem. So in other words, they turn around and go back into a life in faith because they were running away. And the scripture scholars say that they're actually going to Emmaus. And Emmaus was a Roman garrison. So they could have been going over to the enemy. They could have been going to join the Roman side because, hanging around in Jerusalem as a disciple of Jesus could easily get you crucified. So they're on their way to Emmaus. But instead, it says, and with that they got up immediately and returned to Jerusalem. And I love the Jerusalem Bible translation of this text. It says, when they went into the community in Jerusalem, they're greeted with, the Lord has been raised. It is true. He has appeared to Simon. Well, why is it official now that Simon has seen him? Why didn't they believe the women? Well, they went to the tomb and came back and... So it's been the closed-mindedness has been there from the beginning, but they rejoice. But then I love the Jerusalem Bible translation. It says at the end, but then they told their story of what had happened on the road, which was important, but how they'd come to know him in the breaking of the bread. So it was in the relations, the Eucharistic passage, of course, but it's also the bread of friendship, the bread of life, the bread of care, the bread of community, all the breads that we can break. Let me put it into a pedagogy. That's just a picture of the three of them on the road to Emmaus. And he listening to them and they telling him the story and he telling them the great story of faith and then trying to get them to put it together. And it may be as simple as that. Teaching any religion or faith tradition, I think you need to engage students' lives with real themes, issues, desires, access the spiritual wisdom of Christian faith or Muslim faith, whatever story or vision, and then try to encourage them to see for themselves and embrace its spiritual wisdom. I've put it together as pedagogical movements. Let me just review these very briefly and then see if they make any sense to you. But you can imagine this life to faith to life approach as engaging a focusing activity and then five pedagogical movements. Now, the focusing act is simply to get people engaged with a real life issue, a life in faith theme. And that's going to be the curriculum. And then as you begin with life, you invite people to expression from their own praxis, from their own experience around the theme. You get them to talk about it, whatever's going on in their lives. You get them to reflect on it in conversation, reason, memory, imagination. Then from life, you move on then to the faith handed down. You give them persuasive access by reason, desire, to the story and vision of faith, tradition, the theme, whatever is appropriate to the tradition, the theme, the group, the context. I'll give examples in a moment. And then to bring them back to life again, your movement four encourages people's own appropriation, their integration, their seeing for themselves, even to say, what are you thinking? What did you learn in school today? They're getting people not just to report back what you said, but to tell you what they're thinking about what you said. Some of the questions I've asked you here already this morning is that movement four type of question, and then inviting to decision, at least to learn from the spiritual wisdom, and maybe, as appropriate, they may be disposed to choose it as their identity. Let me lay out some examples. I did a high, pardon my language, but I use the word of high school, you know what I mean, that I mean secondary school. I did a unit recently on the Trinity. I was invited into a group of high school theology teachers. It was a large gathering at the LA Congress, which is Gene was at as well with Veritas, and it's an extraordinary event. It's like about 30,000-40,000 people. It's like another Pentecost. Marvelous. It's a great event. But I did a kind of a demonstration lesson that asked me to do some of the Trinity. How do you use this approach to teaching the Blessed Trinity? Now, that's as challenging as you'll get, because how do you get a bunch of high school young people? And there was high school, real life young people there. This was 2 years ago, the Congress before this past one. But how do you get a group of 15 or 16 young high school students interested in the Blessed Trinity? Well, and I'm dating myself now. My focusing activity was I played the Beatles, "What the World Needs Now is Love, Sweet Love." And I had to explain to them that the Beatles came just after the dinosaurs, that the dinosaurs, the next generation was the Beatles. And they got it then. They dated the Beatles about right. And anyway, I had the words of the song. Now, you'd do this far more creatively than I would. I had the words of the song printed out, and we played it, and we looked at the words, and we began to talk about, now, is it true? All the world needs now is love, sweet love, and is that just poppycock, or is that just wishful thinking, or do you agree with it? Do you disagree with it? What do you think yourself? And inviting them to talk about love and what is love anyway, and how do we know what love is? And tell me a story. Were you ever in love? Who loves you? How do you know they love you? How do they love you? How do you experience their love? What is real love? How does it work? Umpteen questions that you can get them to talk about love in their lives and the reality of it and the hopes for it and all the rest of it, and get them to reflect critically on it. Why do we need love? And what is true love? And how do you know when somebody really loves you? What's a good love? What's a bad love? What's a life-giving love? What's a destructive love? What's a possessive love? You get them reflecting on the reality, the praxis, and the reflection of the reality and the desire they have for love in their lives. And indeed, it's writ large in these young people's lives. And then you begin to talk to them about this whole extraordinary dogma or doctrine that we have in Christian faith, that our God is actually a God of triune love, that our God is a God who is love and who is in love in a three-way kind of relationship. We typically call it Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, but you could call it Creator, Redeemer, Sanctifier, whatever names you want to put on it. And you begin to talk, then you can teach them the whole theology of the Trinity, of the Blessed Trinity. And you can talk about circumcision and perichoresis and all kinds of, you can do it as academically rigorous as you can muster to teach this whole notion of this extraordinary symbol. And I explained to these young people that as Catholics, we used to say the Blessed Trinity, oh, it's a mystery. It's a mystery. You can't explain it. And now we don't say that at all. Now we say the Blessed Trinity, it's an extraordinary mystery. And it explains everything. It explains who we are and it explains who our God is. So, yeah, we still can't explain it, but it explains everything. And I explained to them that it explains who are the kind of a God we have, but also the kind of a people we're called to live and to be as made in the image and likeness of this God. And so you begin talking about that our own destiny, our own highest vocation is to love and be loved because we're made in the image and likeness of love. And that in a sense, the Trinity explains who our God is and who we are and how we are to live. So you can do a whole catechesis, and I had about 45 minutes with this group, 50 minutes at most, with this group of 15, 16 young people. But can you give them persuasive access to the story of the Trinity, but also to the vision of the Trinity? And where it calls us, and the kind of person it invites us to be. If you really believe in this kind of a God, then and who are you called to be, etc. And then movement four, moving back to life again, is begin to say, now, what do you think yourself? Could this Trinity thing ever mean anything to you in your life? If you ever took it seriously, what difference would it make? How would you know what is a true love in your life? How would you know what is a false love, a manipulative love, a dangerous love? If you took this Trinity thing seriously, where might it invite you? How would it shape your relationships? And then, of course, movement five is an invitation to some kind of decision. Now, the decisions can be cognitive, affective, or behavioral. But at least to learn from this old, extraordinary dogma, doctrine we have about the triune nature of our God. And what kind of wisdom would be in that now for your own life? How could you take that to heart? And if you ever took it to heart and put it to work in your life, what difference might it make? I gave another example. I was invited at a conference 2 years ago to do a demonstration. Demonstration lessons are terrifying, by the way, because of course they can blow up in your face. But I did a demonstration lesson at an international conference of religious educators, and they asked me to take a theme from Muslim faith, and how would I teach it? And as a good Catholic theologian and everything else, I took the extraordinary Islamic tradition of zakat, which is an amazing aspect of the Muslim tradition. It basically requires people to take 2.5%, not of their earnings, but of their assets every year and give it to the poor. It's not just a philanthropy. Again, it comes out of a deep spirituality. It's a reminder that everything belongs to Allah. And we're just the stewards of it. And we should give back at least 2.5% of it every year, especially to the poor. It's an amazing aspect of Islamic faith. How would I teach it using this approach? We began talking about the reality of hunger in our world, of suffering in our world. And we talked about, and I used statistics and all the kinds of things. You can imagine how you'd focus it. And then talking about what are the hungers? What are the deepest hungers of life? What are your own hungers? In what ways do you experience hunger? Have you ever experienced hunger? Who do you know that is hungry? Why are there hungers? Why are there hungers of the heart? Hungers for bread, hungers for food. Why is there hungers for justice, hungers for freedom? Why is our world so hungry? What causes the hungers? And you can bring in sociology, psychology, history. You can bring in all kinds of resources to reflect upon the reality of hungers. And then I began out of that to begin to share with them this extraordinary Islamic practice of zakat. And I think I explained it fairly well. And not only just the practice of it, but the spirituality behind it, the whole sense of relinquishment and what have you, giving all back to Allah through the poor. And then, because this was a mixed group of students, movement four is to say, now, is there anything we could learn from this? Now, if you're a Muslim, you're bound, you're required by faith to practice zakat. But even as Christians, as atheists, as Buddhists, as Hindus, or whatever we are, is there something here that you find inspiring, confronting, a resource, an insight, an invitation, a wisdom? In other words, movement four is not, typically teachers teach clearly and then say to students, what did I say? What did I tell you? And they simply feed back what we fed out. Now, you want them to know what we said, but much more than that, you want them to take it to heart. You want them to see for themselves, to appropriate it, to make it their own. That's the dynamic of movement four, where you say, what do you really think? And then, is there anything, are you invited? Is there any invitation here? Is there anything you could do with this? Even if it's only to say, well, I'm going to think a lot more about it. At least you're moving them rather than just simply to repeat what you've said. or to feed back to you what you've fed out to them, I think you've got better possibilities. Let me bring you back into the conversation. We just have about 10 minutes left and we will end on time. This life to faith to life, now you could give lots of other examples, and indeed, in some ways it can be easier to use at a primary school level than in a high school, although it has strengths that can be used at a secondary school level as well. And it doesn't always have to be, it can be a life in faith theme. You can begin the conversation with around a faith theme. One of the most successful lessons I've ever taught, and I've taught it many times, is the story of the road to Caesarea Philippi, where it's Matthew 16, or that's Matthew's version of it, where they're going the road to Caesarea Philippi, and he stops and says, who do you think I am? What are the latest rumors? Tell me, what are people saying about me? And it's great to get young people to imagine themselves on the road and to get them into a meditative kind of posture and to say, imagine yourself on the road and you're trudging along and you sit down for a rest at midday and you're parched with the thirst and you stop at a well and you've all have a good drink and you rest a while, and then he looks up and he says to you, so who do people say I am? And they say, oh, a lot of people think, you know, they tell him the latest rumors. And then he looks them in the eye and sticks them to the road and says, but who do you say that I am? And then you can draw out their own praxis, their own experience, their own sense of who Jesus is for them. The point I want to make is that you don't have to postpone the God talk until movement three. You could begin with the God talk. But if you do, it has to be, who is he for you? You can't just say, so who is Jesus? Oh, the Son of God, the second person of the blessed. No. Who do you think he is? Well, how does he function in your life? Who is he for you? Do you know him at all? How do you know him? How do you think he looked like? What kind of a friend do you think he'd be? In other words, ask him their own praxis. This is one of the reasons I call it a shared Christian praxis approach. So rather than beginning with theoria, the theory, begin with their own praxis, their own lives in the world, their own desires, their own hopes, joys, sorrows, their own ideas, their own reasons, their own rationale, whatever it might be. But begin with their own story and get them to tell their story. That's a metaphorical language. But then before you introduce the great story and vision of faith. So the faith language can begin at the beginning and run throughout or whatever. Let me ask you the question that I should ask you. Movement 4 and 5. Your own response to a life to faith to life approach, what do you think? Agreements, reservations, additions, subtractions? In other words, what did you learn in school today? It's a great question to ask, isn't it? What did you learn in school today? Yeah, so write down, we've only 10 minutes left, 7-8 minutes left. What's the best insight, the best wisdom that you're taking away from today, from this morning? Like when you go home, they'll say to you, well, was it any good? And you'll say, a lot of the same old stuff, really, you know. And then your partner or husband or wife or community member says to you, yeah, but did you get anything out of it at all? What would you say? Write it down. Most important note you'll take by far. What did you come to see for yourself today? That maybe you saw already, knew already, but had forgotten, or maybe you gave a bit of a new spin. What's the best thing you're taking away from my ramblings and your own reflections and your conversation with the neighbor? Yeah, there's the question. What did you learn in school today? And how do you put it to work? How will you put it to work? What will you do with it? You might just say, I'm going to go on doing what I was already doing very well, more convinced than ever. That'd be good. Would you go back to the neighbor and give the neighbor a gift? The gift of your own wisdom, insight. And of course, if you drew a blank on my questions, that's a sure sign you should turn to the neighbor, because the neighbor always comes up with something. Yeah. It's not competition we're in. It's the body of Christ working together. Talk to the neighbor. 2 minutes. Tell the neighbor what you're taking away. And then we'll hear from 4 or 5 people. We might go 5 minutes over, Tomas, if I may. We'll come back together. What did you learn in school today, and what are you taking away? Give us a few gifts before we go. Please. A little louder, Tomas, for everybody.
The whole centrality of Jesus, I think, came out very strong.
Good.
Not to be afraid to adapt the teachings of Jesus to the classroom and to share his methods, I suppose, with the teachers.
Mm-hmm.
To be afraid to move away from our own comfort zones.
That's a big one.
Textbook structure and so on, not to be afraid to move away from that.
Yeah.
And challenge that, maybe.
Grand. Great stuff. Thank you. That's a lot to take away. Yourself.
I think to learn just or kind of reaffirmed in the belief that I would have myself as well that catechism or catechesis isn't teaching catechism. And that, you know, so often people are reacting to the crisis of faith by just kind of going back to the 1950s style, just doctrinaire,
yeah,
teaching.
I know.
And going back to the Apostles' Creed and just doing it only in terms of that, without really appealing to people's kind of, you know, good nature and that, and working with people as they are.
Yeah.
So,
great stuff.
The advantage of the approach that it kind of is, it just begins from where people are at rather than ramming Catholicism down their throats.
Yes. Great points. Thank you. And it's tempting to go back to the old ways and to say that it worked. I've had people say, oh, should we know our faith when we had the catechism? Now we don't know our faith at all. The answer is, no, you didn't. We never knew our faith. Catholics never knew our faith, really.
And that's why we don't have it today.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we never understood it, and there's a little bit of a wave, and
exactly.
It's gone.
The Maynooth Catechism had 11 questions and answers on limbo and purgatory, and had none on Easter. None. None on the meaning of Easter. It says, what was Easter? Easter was that Jesus rose from the dead, and on the third day after his death, Jesus rose from the dead. And then it goes on. But nothing about it. What difference is making in our life? So that very often the version that we had, even in the old catechism, was kind of distorted. So that we often think we knew it, but you're... And even if it did know it, I think maybe it's just, it certainly sustained my parents, grandparents, and what have you. We're all catechism Catholics, really, in the sense that we inherited it out of catechism. But it won't work. It's tempting to go backwards, but it would be defeating, I think, especially with this generation. And we can do better, is the point. We don't need to go back. Great point. Thank you.
For me, the most powerful was the picture of Jesus teaching.
Ah.
And then I said to myself, what would somebody have to say? What would they have to be like for me to follow them and to listen and to live the way they wanted?
Yeah.
And that's really what we're talking about.
It is.
Is to try and get children or young people to see Jesus. So for me, it would be, for me to follow them, they would have to answer a massive need within me that isn't being answered.
Yeah.
Okay. And I suppose for some children, younger people at the moment, there is a huge lack of hope.
Yes. Yes.
And that if they could see the hope that Jesus brings.
Yes.
I think.
And that the grace of God brings,
yes,
that they have help.
And that they're loved.
And that they're loved, that they don't have to do it all by their own effort. It'll take a hell of an effort. Ask any good alcoholic. It's a hell of a struggle to get a and yet they know that they have this higher power that can help them to do it. Like, that's core to Catholic faith. One of the best aspects of the tradition, our theology of nature and grace. And not to be unecumenical, but you won't find it nearly as obvious in the Protestant tradition, especially in the Calvinist tradition. It's all by God's grace. But by God's grace that works through our good efforts, that's what makes the difference. And you'll always have the grace of God. I think I have a slide on it. You do the best you can. Yeah, it's always at high tide, this grace of God. And it's a wonderful resource that can give hope, as you say, when the hope is scarce. Please.
It's the life to faith to life.
Yes.
But that, I think, is something that we might have been missing.
Yeah.
Just bringing it back.
Yeah. And it can be as simple as saying, rather than saying, what did I tell you? And they write it down, they get an A. It's saying, what do you think about what we just learned? Does it make any sense? Is it any good? What would you do with it? What difference would it make? Supposing you took it seriously. Is there any insight here? Anything you could learn from this? I mean, they're very simple questions. But it's that appropriation question, that making your own question, rather than what did I say? Can you remember it? Yeah. Now, the last thought I'll leave you with, and I just want to tell this quick story.
One thing before you finish. Everybody would appreciate it, that a lot of our teachers are very reluctant to engage in that kind of conversation.
I know.
With the young people, to actually tease out what they think, how they feel, what they got from it.
Yeah.
That's the biggest problem, is getting the teachers to be comfortable.
Yeah.
Let the youngsters talk, you know?
Yeah. How do you think you might get them a little more comfortable?
Get the teachers?
Yeah. Yeah, teasing it out with them. And they're not invasive questions. They shouldn't be, you know, inappropriate questions. But asking people, what do you really think? What do you see for yourself? It's difficult, especially we're so often ready to settle for simply, tell me what I told you, and I'll grade you on it. Yeah. When you go back to the historical Jesus, it's lovely with young people. You have to, when you're going back to the historical Jesus, this is just a quickie. I shouldn't even take 3 more minutes, Tomas, and I definitely quit because I know you have wonderful presentations coming. But go back to the real Jesus, and especially for young people. The greatest story in there for young people, I always think, is the finding in the temple. But you have to go back to the real Jesus, to the real Mary, to the real Joseph. And I think I'll just leave you with this thought, because you can do this throughout the whole gospel. But it's fascinating. Remember the five joyful mysteries ended in the finding in the temple. And then the first sorrowful mystery was the agony of the guard. So again, the rosary left out his life. But anyway, now the luminous mysteries, and that's an improvement. But it's a great story, but it says that he's missing a day. They're gone a whole day out of Jerusalem, and they miss him. And you can imagine the conversation. I often ask young people, now imagine the conversation between Mary and Joseph when they realized. And what do you think they said? What do you think they said to each other? They probably said, I thought he was with you. I never said he was with my people. You said he was coming home with your people. I never said he was coming home with my people. Where do you think? I thought you were bringing him. I never said I was bringing him. And you get this huge argument with Mary and Joseph. And then the poor people, they go charging back into Jerusalem. And 2 days later, this kid is missing 3 days. You can imagine, and I asked the young people, now imagine the anxiety, the deep fear, the trauma in Joseph and Mary, and they're blaming each other. We should have brought him, and why did we leave him behind? And why did we take him? He's coming home with his cousins. We never should have given permission. And you can imagine the terrible trauma they're in. Here's their only son lost in a dangerous city, 12 years of age. I mean, he was probably killed by now. And finally, the last place to look for him is in the temple. The last place they look. It says they searched everywhere, and then they went to the temple. So he was a normal 12-year-old. He didn't go to church the first place that he went. And they walk, and according to Luke's gospel, Mary walked into the temple, cool as a cucumber, and said, "Son, why have you done this to us? Your father and I have sought you with anxiety." And then I say to young people, now, do you think that's really what happened? What do you think really happened? And then they say, oh, Jesus, no, Mary, Jesus. Mary rushed into that temple and threw her arms around him and said, Mother of God, where have you been? We'd be worried sick about you. And what did you do, you stupid kid? What the hell were you doing running away like that? Come back. I'll swear to God, I'll kill you myself if you don't ever do something like that again. And they get imagining, what did Mary say to her? What did Joseph say? Joseph, give him a hug. Oh, my God, look at him. Oh, my God, we'd be worried sick about you. Where have you been? And then I think, now, what do you think of Jesus' response? I get them to imagine, what would Jesus? Jesus said to her, Mom, you should have known where to look for me. Now, what do you think Mary said next? I bet Mary lost it. I bet she flipped her top, her lid. My God, what do you mean? Well, the gospel doesn't tell us what happened next. But the next verse in Luke, it's in Luke chapter 2, says he went down to Nazareth and was obedient to them. I bet he was. I bet he was. That poor kid was so scared he didn't leave home again until he was 30 years of age. And then it says, and he grew. He grew in wisdom, age, and grace with God and all the people. Who do you think grew him? Well, Mary, Joseph. Where did he get his extraordinary values? Where did he get his extraordinary outlook on life? Our faith says that the divinity never suspended the humanity. So you can imagine the love there was between Mary and Joseph for him to come out with this thing about loving enemies. I mean, what a loving relationship that must have been between Joseph and Mary, that they would have a son that had such a radical notion of love, because we believe that the divinity never suspends. And anyway, I'm just giving you, when you go back to the historical Jesus, I suppose I'm saying to you, have fun as well as everything else, and imagine it. Get them, get young people to imagine how it really was, and they'll get the hang of it. Blessings, sorry for going over 10 minutes. My joy of being with you, and blessings upon your good work. Thank you.